Will this baloney smell up this conference room?
Today on ELT, we torture listener Samantha with a baloney experiment.
Hi, ELT and Flora.
And this is how it began. Samantha called with a question of taste, like actual tastes, the ones that we have in our mouth. Sweet, salty, bitter, sour, savory, or umami. You've probably learned about them. There are five. Or are there? Samantha has a hypothesis that she can taste one additional taste, a secret sixth taste, the taste of fat. And Samantha has an unusual relationship to taste.
I was born with the inability to smell, and I've been walking around touting that fat is a taste, that I can taste it because I can't smell, but I really need the facts. Who knows if they even exist? I thought if they did, you would be able to find them.
Hello.
Hey, Samantha, it's Flora. So tell me why you are going around town touting fat facts.
I don't know if there's five tastes or six tastes, and when you've only got that many, that kind of difference of one is a big deal.
Yeah, I guess smell is a big part of eating.
Right, because most of the way people taste food is through smell. So I'm definitely missing kind of major food experiences. Like, I will never send something back to the kitchen because I just figure that it's lost on me.
Are there things that you see your smeller friends eating that you're like, why?
Scallops really put me off when I was a kid. I can't taste scallops pretty much at all.
So it's like a rubbery ball in your mouth.
Yes, it's a rubbery ball.
Well, does it go the other way? Are there things that you eat that your smeller friends are like, I don't get it?
For sure. Like burnt food, that doesn't really bother me. Food that might smell bad, like food that's been out too long, that's something I'd probably eat by accident.
What's the worst thing you've eaten?
I have gotten to like the end of a sandwich and found like really green meat.
Green meat?
Yeah, it was like a bad bologna situation.
That is the worst meat it could be. Do you think that without smell, you're better at deciphering those tongue tastes?
I think I can pretty clearly draw a line between the other tastes I have. They're not kind of muddied in any way by smells. If something is sweet and sour, I can taste both of those things distinctly.
And you think fat is a taste?
Yes. I read an article years ago that someone was on a soapbox about fat being a taste. And I was like, oh, man, I want to know whether or not. And I could never, like, track down that scientist.
Hello.
So we did.
Oh, that's amazing.
This is fat taste guru Richard Mattis.
Well, I don't know that I'd go for guru. How about czar? No, I'm kidding.
This is taste czar Richard Mattis. And he has been studying this very question, whether fat is a taste, for decades.
Wow, I'm so excited. It's really a scientific question.
Actually, it's been debated since Aristotle.
Samantha, Aristotle agreed with you.
Aristotle thought fatty was a basic taste quality.
Great minds, you know?
So for 2 millennia and 8 minutes, including this podcast, people have been debating whether fat is a taste or not.
So that makes me think, what is their definition of taste?
You'd think that was a simple question.
But there's no czar-sanctioned taste definition. There's not even a committee of taste czars.
There is no governing board that passes judgment on this and says, yes, those are the necessary and sufficient criteria. Anything that satisfies all those, we will call taste.
It's so interesting that we haven't worked this out yet when it's such a fundamental part of our lives.
Yeah.
Regarding fat, there's no official taste test, but there are guidelines that scientists use today. One, to be a taste, you need special receptors for the taste. That's sensors on your tongue that register just that taste. And those seem to be there for fat.
We're pretty confident.
Okay.
And two, and this one seems obvious, to be a taste, people need to be able to taste that taste. So I thought we could do a little experiment.
Yeah.
Will you tell Stell, the engineer who is recording you right now, to get out the bologna.
Ugh. She wants you to get out the bologna. Wow, beef bologna.
We want you to reclaim your relationship with bologna.
Okay, that's... do you want me to eat a slice of this bologna, sashimi style?
I'm sorry, and you're welcome. Yes.
Okay. I'm opening the package of Oscar Mayer bologna. Ooh, it's really wet.
Tell me how it feels in your hands.
It feels exactly like a deli meat that's made of mushed up other deli meats.
Okay, will you put that composite meat in your mouth and tell us what the taste of fat tastes like?
Okay. Wow. It is a texture way more than it's a taste.
Like what?
Like the worst flan.
You're onto something with that.
From a texture perspective, fats add lubricity, creaminess.
Are you tasting the lubricity?
Yes. And that's been my like a major experience of fat, how it coats your mouth.
Right. That's the feel of fat.
And it's different than the taste.
Right. So what are you tasting? You can take another bite of that bologna.
Oh, thanks. It's like kind of sweet and very savory.
And what about the taste in question?
It's like, it's an oil. It's kind of like olive oil, but without that like funny olive taste.
An oily taste. Okay, that is the taste of fat to you.
Yes.
Moment of truth. Are you right? Is there some science to back up fat as its own taste?
Samantha, in my opinion, yes. There is the taste to fat.
And your oil diagnosis is very similar to Dr. Mattis's description.
It's a sensation that you pick up from, say, rancid cooking oil.
In fact, the flavor of fat gets stronger as food goes bad, as the bologna gets greener. And scientists are still hashing out how much you can taste this in fresh foods. But if you just isolate the taste of fat, and that's what Richard Mattis did in his experiments, it's not delicious.
It's extremely unpleasant.
I feel like that's a pretty good description of the fatty taste of bologna. It all tastes a little rancid. It's just something a little wrong with it.
Samantha, to sum up, there is evidence supporting your hypothesis that fat is a taste, but it is not a done deal in the scientific establishment. There's still debate about the receptors, about how tastable it is.
Man, I can just picture like a group of old men scientists being like, it's not distinct enough.
It is a very subtle sensation. We don't have vocabulary for it, so it's difficult for people to find it.
I do think putting a label on something, putting a name on something helps people understand it. And it's really hard to know what you're dealing with or what you're experiencing if you don't have words to describe it.
Yeah, I've heard people talk about this with colors, right? Like you might not be able to recognize a color till it's named.
Yeah.
Rick Mattis tried to solve this vocabulary problem by coming up with a name for the taste of fat, a name that perhaps they should have focus grouped.
Ole Augustus, the Latin oleo is fat and gustus is taste, so fat taste.
That's really bad.
Did you try out other names? Why did you land on? It's very highfalutin. Like you could have gone with like fatsicle.
It is a term that doesn't roll off the tongue easily. And it may be that the chemical senses community doesn't accept it.
But who knows? Maybe fat has a chance. Umami did it. Though it took decades for that to become a Trader Joe's condiment and officially sanctioned taste in the West. Also, it's not just fat. People are campaigning for other tastes as well.
What? I want to know what those tastes are. Am I tasting them?
Yeah, so humans may be able to taste starch.
Like baked potato taste?
Perhaps, yeah.
I call, like, foods that aren't potatoes, I call potato-y.
And there's evidence for calcium taste. There is evidence for water taste.
I'm intrigued by that one.
I'm intrigued, too. I'm intrigued by all of them. Because you've just told me that my extremely kind of tunnel vision experience of food I might have like double or more.
What are you going to do with the bologna?
I'm probably going to leave a note on it and put it in the staff room to see if it'll go.
Samantha, it's not going to go. After the break, a very important flamenco update. Okay, so for the rest of this episode, we are bringing you a much-needed flamingo update. Just to recap, here's where we left off. We discovered that flamingos can drink boiling water. They live in caustic, skin-melting ponds. They get frozen into their beds at night. And the first seven letters of their name is flaming. And as you know, we have been working on a grassroots campaign to get flamingos the respect that they deserve. Hashtag yes, flamingo. I'm here with Sarah Laskow, Atlas Obscura reporter and flamingo supporter.
Yes, definitely. Flamingo fan.
You contacted us with some flamingo intelligence.
Yes. So flamingos are the only animals that successfully escape from zoos. All other animals, they get out, they get caught, they're back in the cage. Flamingos, no. They fly away, they're free, and they remain free forever.
Multiple flamingos.
Yeah. There are at least three very famous flamingos who have escaped from zoos and are still on the lam.
What's the most famous flamingo escapee?
The most famous one is probably Pink Floyd, who escaped in Utah and made his home in the Great Salt Lake for many, many years.
See, it all started at the Tracy Aviary in 1988 on wing feather cutting day. Pink Floyd was hiding.
And usually what happens in these cases is that the flamingos, their zookeepers let their feathers grow a little bit too long, and all of a sudden they can fly again. And so they just take off. And so Pink Floyd escaped from the zoo, and no one was able to bring him back.
And the aviary gave up and secretly admitted that he had beat the system.
Pink Floyd is refusing to be another brick in the wall.
Yes.
Is it that they're too cunning to get brought back to the zoo?
I don't know if they do anything particularly clever, but it goes back to what you've been saying all of this time about flamingos. They can survive under basically any conditions that are thrown out at them. So it doesn't matter where they are in the world. These flamingo escapees have come from Japan. They've been in Utah. They've been in Louisiana and Texas. And they can deal with all these different conditions. So once they get free, they don't have any problems. They're fine. And I think the other really key part is that flamingos are not harming anybody. And no one really wants them to be caught. Whereas if there's a tiger roaming around your city, you want that to be caught.
People want them to be free.
Yeah, for sure.
It makes me feel like there's legs to our flamingo respect campaign.
Definitely.
A leg.
A leg.
A single long leg. So, as you know, part of our mission is to get flamingos to be a mascot of a major sports team.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's been some good news recently.
Oh, yeah?
Do you follow hockey?
Not really.
Yeah. Well, I read that this year has been a really wild year for hockey because this new expansion team formed in Las Vegas. Their mascot is officially a Golden Knight.
Fine.
And you know the deal with expansion teams. Like, they're never...
What is an expansion team?
It's a new team.
Okay.
The team was cobbled together. This one was cobbled together in less than a year from NHL castoffs. And just, like, there was no expectation that they would do anything. The amazing thing about this story is that they are in the Stanley Cup Finals.
And it's over. And the Vegas Golden Knights will play for the Stanley Cup.
Oh, so that's a big surprise.
Total surprise. It's like being talked about as this amazing underdog story, or perhaps I should say underbird story. because their unofficial mascot is none other than the pink flamingo.
What?
I know. Basically, the story is a fan threw a pink flamingo on the ice during one game, and it caught on.
What started as a flamingo fad has turned into a full-on frenzy. Originally just
not a real flamingo. A fake flamingo.
A fake flamingo.
Okay, great. When is there going to be a real flamingo thrown on the ice?
Flapped onto the ice.
Yeah. I am imagining that the ultimate feat would be to get a live flamingo into this hockey rink and release it in a celebratory moment and let it fly free.
Like when they win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah. Not just flamingos on the ice, but celebratory real live flamingos that get to be free. Because as we know, it's fine. They'll do great.
Exactly. Look out for Sarah's stories in Atlas Obscura. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Every Little Thing is produced by Phoebe Flanagan, Aaron Reese, Bradley Campbell, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Ian Chillug and Caitlin Kenny. Scoring by Dara Hirsch and Haley Shaw. Mixing by Dara Hirsch and Emma Munger. I can drink boiling water too. Goodbye.